The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Now, run later. You see where the technology's going. But now, you know, I guess where the technology is at the moment, sign me up for the humanoid games. I'm going to compete in the shoulder press humanoid games next year in Beijing. We'll see. We'll see how that goes. The technology, though, it's definitely moving fast, as we've been covering on quite a few shows in these last few weeks. The last show of the week. Hard to believe you're listening to Stephen Fleury. This is the Trumpet Daily. We appreciate you joining us on today's show. Decided to start with something that really doesn't have anything to do with anything I want to talk about today. But we can do that from time to time. A little bit of levity here at the start. A lot to get to on today's show. We've got a great, I think, 15-minute segment or so from Let the Stones Speak, Brent Noctegal's podcast. He sat down with Professor Garfinkel. They just started the OFEL, well, I guess just being about 3-4 weeks ago. They're about to finish it up here in a couple of weeks. But in any event, he's talking to the one presiding over that dig, and it's an interesting conversation, and also just a good update from Jerusalem. Friday, of course, means we've got another segment for World Watch as well. So lots of content to get to. And now I'll play the cold open that I had lined up probably up until about 10:50, and then decide at the last minute, let's go with the robots. Start the show with the robots. Here, more seriously, is a montage we put together about Germany, the Holy Roman Empire, quite a few subjects that we get into a lot on this program. Here's a clip two.
European prices remain 2 to 3 times higher than in the US and China. And what's more, over half of the energy we consume still depends on imported fossil fuels. This is a costly dependence. Since the start of the crisis in the Middle East, this dependence has already cost us 50 billion euros extra without receiving a single extra molecule of energy. So we must produce our own low-carbon energy in Europe. And thanks to renewable energy and thanks to nuclear energy, over 70% of our electricity is already produced from low-carbon sources in Europe. Ladies and gentlemen, the European budget must also scale up. the next budget will be the financial engine of our independence. Europe cannot set new ambitions without giving itself the means to finance them.
Gradually, and now faster and faster, a new power is being developed from underneath the surface, a new world power, which the public now least suspects, which the world does not yet see, doesn't realize, doesn't dream is coming, but it is developing just as prophesied in Europe, a resurrected Roman Empire that will combine some 350 millions of population, a power so mighty that our Western peoples will stand aghast when it flashes suddenly into full being. Yes, your Bible says that the world will be startled.
Europe has arrived at the crossroads of destiny. Like apocalyptic horsemen, the harbingers of ruin loom over our continent. War and violence, lies and then freedom, impoverishment, and the deliberate destruction of prosperity. These are the great perils of our age. They strike at the very core of our culture, our value, and our way of life. We Europeans are heirs to a magnificent, utterly unique historical and cultural legacy. Our civilization rests upon three pillars: the searching mind of Greek philosophy, the majestic order of Roman statecraft, and the redeeming light of the Christian tradition. From these roots sprang the treasures we hold sacred.
However, let me say that the resurrection of this so-called Holy Roman Empire that existed from 554 on to 1814 in Europe will trigger World War III.
So you know all about the prophecies of God and what Herbert Armstrong taught for so many decades. But there you hear from European leaders, von der Leyen, talking about a new budget is needed for Europe. Will this be the budget for the seventh and final resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire? And then the AfD leader there toward the end, she's calling for, and the AfD is just getting more and more popular, the far-right party. She's calling for Europe to return to its traditions, Greece and Rome and Catholicism. What about the downside of those traditions or the violence that those traditions have promoted? The trigger that it's been for war, world war even. She says these three pillars, Greek philosophy, the majestic order of Roman statecraft, and of course the redeeming light of Christian tradition. This article at Politico regarding the AfD and the far right in Germany. Germany's far right taps nostalgia for communist East to propel election surge. It says here, Germany's far right is betting that an unabashed embrace of nostalgia for life behind the Iron Curtain, the AfD's reaching out to those areas that used to be behind that curtain, talks about an event they had, and later on it says it's also part of a broader political message for an electorate that in great part perceives the country to be in economic and social decline, a promise that the party will bring the people back to the halcyon time when things were supposedly simpler and better, even if that means life in a former dictatorship. It talks about the resentment that some of these people have for America, the resentment they have for all of these immigrants that are just pouring into the continent. That's still happening. We've got footage of Soweto where the locals they're staging protests and knocking over some of these tent camps. They're fed up. They're fed up with their government. And that same sentiment, it's there in Germany as well. When the strong man arrives, this article at Politico, a lot of migrant troublemakers were refusing to conform, it quotes this guy as saying. Those people must be sent home through deportation. We've got to get rid of them. This is happening all over the world. I mentioned Soweda. You can just play the clip of the protesting there, clip 6.
The Spanish government have finally got their heads out of the sand and acknowledged the atrocities they've allowed to happen in the Spanish city of Soweta. Defense Minister Margarita Robles told a parliamentary committee, "I want to apologize to all those who may have felt or who even feel abandoned or not sufficiently cared for. I have witnessed firsthand your feelings of anxiety, of abandonment, of lack of safety." But the Spanish minister's words were a case of too little, too late for the desperate people of Soweta, who have been staging protests, voicing their frustration with the situation. Anger reached fever pitch overnight as Soweta locals clashed with illegal Moroccan migrants, forcing police to intervene. The violence further fueled the tension that has plagued the small Spanish enclave for weeks. Police fired rubber bullets into the crowd in a bid to break up the protests that took place around the city.
I guess they've had enough of the military-aged Muslims roaming the streets of this little town. As I say, it's a worldwide problem. What a way to turn a nation or a continent upside down. There's this great piece at Chronicles, the website, just about how illegal immigration has punished and hurt, in some ways destroyed, what was America. When you step back and, you know, look beyond just one incident, people pouring into Soweta just a few weeks ago, but what's happened over the past half century, this article says, look at your paycheck, look at your rent or mortgage bill as it arrives every month, look at the overcrowded classroom where your child sits, the emergency room wait times that stretch into hours, the grocery bill that climbs while your income stagnates. Then ask yourself a simple question: who is this system really serving? We talked yesterday about the abuse of power in local government, state government, federal government. Trillions and trillions of dollars just being wasted, thrown to the wind, paying for vacations. Is the government really there serving children in the case of education? Well, and how does opening the floodgates to illegal immigrants coming from all over the world, what a burden that puts on, you know, society, education. You just go right down the list. It's not you, this article says. It's not your neighbors in the factories that the government's looking out for, that is. The warehouses, the suburban office parks, or the trades. The American working class, blue collar and white collar alike, has been systematically hoodwinked into cheering an immigration policy that dilutes their wages and endangers their neighborhoods, their children's future, and even their collective political voice. These are all signs that this world is about to explode. Whether you look at America or Soweta, Germany, it's a sign of instability. Upside down. It's all upside down. You can't fault people for, you know, fleeing their country to try to seek a better life. But a lot of them are coming in with a criminal record. Or maybe as radical Muslims looking to rape and maim and murder. We've seen examples of this in Britain and elsewhere. This is America we're talking about. Between 1980 and 2020, so a 40-year period, the foreign-born share of the U.S. population roughly doubled. The foreign-born share It doubled in size in just four decades. Harvard economist George Boris and others have documented that a 10% increase in the supply of workers in a skill group can reduce wages for similar native workers by 3 to 4% in construction, meat packing, hospitality, service sectors. The effect is even more harsh. More applicants means less bargaining power, means smaller paychecks. It's a ticking time bomb, and it's going to go off here in America. It's about to go off in Germany, in Europe, even as Europe is positioning itself for the future to become a superpower, completely independent of America, with its own military machine, headed up by Germany, and a strong man that's prophesied in Daniel 8 and 11. Mr. Armstrong was right. This Politico piece about von der Leyen and the new budget. The EU's next seven-year budget needs to finance the bloc's independence from foreign powers. They're already resetting their budgets, their national budgets, to include much more on defense spending, military spending. Now they're talking about, okay, Europe, we need a budget that allows for us to be completely independent. It says here, Europe cannot set new ambitions without providing the means to finance them, she said. Further on, well, I could probably skip over that. Foreign Affairs has another piece about the great rebalancing that is coming. Again, a world that is unstable in every respect. The trade imbalances that have come to characterize the global economy are fundamentally untenable. China, Germany, and a handful of other economies run large, persistent trade surpluses, while the U.S. absorbs much of these surpluses by running the world's largest trade deficit. Sooner or later, something must give. For an advanced, capital-rich economy, such as that of the United States, an enduring trade deficit will bring with it either rising unemployment or national debt or rising debt, neither of which is sustainable. And we've been discussing this, you know, with other stories regarding America for some time now. Just yesterday on the show, trillions and trillions of dollars that we just threw at problems, especially during the COVID era. And we now come to find out it's just all being wasted, stolen. What an abuse of power. And the best we can get out of it, as far as punishment goes, is just an uncomfortable hearing, and that's about it. A great rebalancing is coming, and Foreign Affairs doesn't even understand what it actually is going to look like, but it knows it's coming. It says here, because the major players disagree about the causes of the imbalances, they are unlikely to come to a solution. As one economist wrote at Financial Times, if there is little prospect of preemptive action, the second best option is to prepare for a crisis. In other words, if it can't be solved, if it can't be fixed, if governments can't be relied upon to fix these problems, well, prepare for a crisis. Prepare for a society-wide pain or sickness or illness. Individual economies are now doing just that. History shows that trade imbalances of this scale almost always end painfully, and that the pain of the adjustment is not distributed evenly. You see, what they're talking about is mart of nations, trade war. This imbalance, it's leading to a new world order. And we've got to be ready for the crisis. We've got to be emotionally prepared, spiritually prepared. Coming back to the States, it talks here about just how popular socialism is in the United States, and how much so many Americans depend on government for handouts. And as you heard yesterday, the government officials are happy to hand them out as long as they're giving away other people's money. It says here, our ever-expanding welfare state has taught not just the poor, but the more than one-third of Americans receiving some form of assistance to expect government to meet their needs. More of those who do not qualify for such aid are gaming the system, especially through bogus disability claims or committing outright fraud. Again, we got into a lot of that yesterday. Everybody else is getting their piece. Why shouldn't I? If everybody cheats, if everybody steals, if there's trillions of dollars that everybody can keep printing and spending, why shouldn't I get some of it? That's the thinking. That's human nature. It says, as the two parties battle it out, well, before that, both political parties pander to this childish sense of entitlement. That's true. They both make promises that they can't keep, that are unrealistic, that are unsustainable. They're both addicted to debt, deficit spending. Both parties. It says, as the two parties battle it out, we pretend we're engaged in a deeply serious debate weighing competing visions of our nation. Oh, the midterms are coming up. We've got to save our nation. We've got to get out the vote so we can have some solutions, finally. Well, that's like a broken record. You know this. We hear this every election cycle. It says, but much of that sound and fury is childish babble. The politics of temper tantrums and empty slogans. It says further on, the result is that we're a Peter Pan nation where citizens and their leaders seek to avoid the hard and rewarding challenges of adulthood in the quest to remain childlike forever. We're just children. Well, that sounds familiar. If you know Isaiah 3, the leaders even behaving like little children. Nowadays, growing numbers of the well-off and the poor see handouts as their birthrights in a quest to turn life into one big cradle until the grave. Not everybody, of course, but ever-growing numbers. Look at the direction. Look at the sins of our nations. Look at how they're worsening. Melanie Phillips has a piece here about Britain's moral depravity. Just shocking, the level of filth and evil, violence, division, strife. She says at one point, it is, of course, extraordinary for the foreign minister of one country to order the government of another country to alter its policy because he disapproves of it. I'm picking it up in the middle of an example that she cites. But she's talking about Israel and the Arabs calling upon, you know, Jew-free living, and they get the support from the international community. Many incidents claimed as settler violence are fabricated by malicious actors, both Israelis and others on the far left. And on it goes, the sickness. It runs deep. It runs deep, and there are no solutions. In government, there's no solution offered in education. Education makes it worse. And then you look at religion. We talked, I think I spent almost an hour on it this morning in class. Fake religion, as we set up the book of Galatians. Martin Luther said, I love Galatians. I'm married to that book. Oh, I can't get enough of it. It says you don't need any works. You don't have to do anything. I love that book. Now, the book of James, I don't like that one so much. It's an epistle of straw. Well, who does he think he is? I suppose he fancied himself as a theologian, but newsflash, you don't get to decide which part of the book applies. Now, you do get to choose whether you're going to submit to God's authority or not. God did make us free moral agents. But look at the way our society is constructed, whether it's the fields of education, religion, the economy, government spending, immigration practices or policies. They're all systems of this world, and nothing's working. Everything's making it worse. And we go through this endless cycle, every election cycle. Okay, we just got, we certainly can't lose to the other side, or then we're finished. But if we win, it's golden. Everything is solved. That's not what's been happening. What we need is repentance. What we need is a return to God. And that's what this message is about, the Father's love. This is my father's new book. We're going to be advertising this on the Key of David soon. It says underneath the title, an urgent message for God's sons, both faithful and prodigal. This world has now, it's been a prodigal son for 6,000 years. As we've gone it alone, without God interfering or involved in our lives, wasting away the fortune. And now here we are in the very last stages of this experiment, cut off from the tree of life, cut off from God's Spirit, except for a select few called in advance to assist Jesus Christ as his bride. There's a section in chapter 3 of this book where it goes through Jeremiah 2. And again, as my father has explained, those early chapters of Jeremiah, it's really God the Father reaching out to prodigal sons. He quotes from Jeremiah 2, verses 4 and 5. Now God begins, well, that's my father actually setting it up. Here's the scripture. Hear you the word of the Lord, O house of Jacob, and all the families of the house of Israel. Thus saith the Lord, what iniquity have your fathers found in me, that they're gone far from me and have walked after vanity and are become vain? Well, what's the problem here? You used to love me. You used to follow me. You used to support me. And what iniquity did they find in me to justify their departure? What a disturbing question, my father says. What fault did they find in me that they left me, God asks. And then my father says, ask yourself, have you given God any cause to ask such a question of you? None of us has any excuse to treat God in such a way. Humans sin and make mistakes that might give others cause to turn away from them. God never does. He is the perfect Father. And Jesus Christ is the perfect husband. And they're there with open arms, awaiting our return, our turn from our wicked ways and into the arms of our loving Father, the Father's love. In class this morning, I read through Galatians 4, and where Paul is, well, in chapter 1, you see he's shocked. He can't believe that brethren that he had just visited a few years earlier had turned away from the true gospel to something that came out of the mind of the devil, the devil's religion. Paul says in Galatians 4:13, you know how through infirmity of the flesh I preached the gospel unto you at the first, at the start, I preached the gospel to you. You rejoiced, you loved it. You received it. Verse 14, and my temptation which was in my flesh you despised not, nor rejected. He had an infirmity, and perhaps it was visible. He didn't like it, but the brethren, they didn't see that when they saw Paul. They saw the gospel. They saw a God-fearing man. They actually saw Jesus Christ. It says here, you receive me as an angel of God, even as Christ Jesus. That's how you received me at the beginning, at the start. And then he says, very emotionally here, verse 15, where is then the blessedness that you spoke of? What happened? Where's that attitude you had at the start? Where's the love? What iniquity have you found in me? What is it that you're using to excuse your turn, your departure from the true gospel message? It's easy to just immerse ourselves into sin and to excuse it and to say, well, it's God's fault. It's somebody else's fault. Or to get into that attitude. Well, if everybody's stealing, I might as well steal. I might as well get my piece. That's the way of this world. Every man doing what seems right in his own eyes, according to his reasoning, his nature, his carnality. Where is then the blessedness you spoke of? For I bear you record that if it had been possible, you would have plucked out your own eyes and given them to me. Whatever his thorn was, maybe it had to do with his eyesight, his eyes, his appearance, his face. And he says, you loved me so much at the start, you would have plucked out your own eyes if it would have helped me physically. Where then? Where is the blessedness, the love that you had at the start? The love of God, it does wax cold, as Jesus said in Matthew 24. We can get cold and hard and stubborn. We can get into a foul attitude. We can start accusing God himself. And God still will forgive. If we turn from our wicked ways, if we turn back to the true gospel, back in chapter 1 of this book, Galatians, he straight away is defending his apostleship because brethren were calling it into question, saying he wasn't a real apostle or he was fake, insincere. Verse 6, Paul says, I marvel that you are so soon removed from him that called you into the grace of Christ and unto another gospel. I'm just shocked at what you people have done, given how you started. Where's the blessedness that you had for me at the start? What happened? What went wrong? Who are the insurrectionists that have taken you away from the truth? You had the true gospel. You know, another thing this highlights, as do other letters, every epistle, you've got some instruction in there about apostasy, rebellion, falling away, getting complacent, falling from grace even. There's a lot of people in traditional Christianity that don't even believe that can happen. They think it's impossible. Once you're saved, you're always saved. You can do whatever you want for the rest of your life. That's why Luther loved Galatians, because, well, he took a few of those scriptures like Galatians 3, 1 and 2, you can read it later, and he twisted it and distorted it and taught that, well, Jesus did everything for you. You don't have to do anything. Well, when Galatians talks about Christ in you or Christ being formed in you, let's talk about that. Because who and what was Jesus Christ? How did he live? Hebrews 13 says he's the same yesterday, today, and forever. So if he's living in you, how are we living? Is it like Christ? Is he really being formed in us? Or are we just fakes and frauds and phonies? God wants to know. God does know. He does know. He knows about how fired up we were at the very beginning of our first love. And he knows where we are today. God said to the brethren in this Ephesus era of the church, go back and do the first works. Do what you were doing at the start. Get that fire for Christian living like you once had it. Return to God. I'm just shocked you've turned to another gospel. In verse 7, he says, which is not another, but there be some that trouble you and would pervert the gospel of Christ. If that was true in the first century, how much more true is it today? How many people are out there perverting the true gospel of Christ? This was in 49 AD or thereabouts. Jesus died in 31. AD. Paul showed up in these Galatian congregations in 44, 45, 46 AD. So in the span of 3 or 4 years, these people had turned to a false, phony, fake gospel. If that happens to us, whether it's during 3 years or 30 years, God just says, look, come back. Return. This is a message. It's a message for faithful sons and prodigal sons as well. With that, we'll transition into that segment from Let the Stones Speak. Brent Nachtigall will update you on the Ophel work there in Jerusalem. And then I think we still have enough time for World Watch at the very end. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Thanks for joining us today. Thanks for joining us all week. And we'll see you next time.
Hello and welcome back to Let the Stone Speak. I'm Brent Nachtigall, the host of the program. I'm here on the Ophel in Jerusalem. To my left, your right, is the southern wall of the Temple Mount with the Al-Aqsa Mosque in the distance. I'm on the Ophel, which is this area between the Temple Mount wall and the City of David towards the south. And we're here conducting archaeological excavations in Area E with Hebrew University's Professor Yosef Garfinkel directing the excavation. Most of the team being made up with students from Herbert W. Armstrong College.
Oh, Quinn.
We're very happy to be finally excavating this location, somewhere where the late Dr. Elot Mazar really wanted to dig for the potentialities of finding biblical Jerusalem, Jerusalem from the time of Judah's biblical kings all the way back to King Solomon. We're only just starting the project. We're 2 weeks down of a 5-week season. We hope to do more seasons early next year as well. But to kick us off, I have just completed an interview with Professor Garfinkel, letting you know about what we're planning on doing here, what we're hoping to accomplish with this brand new excavation here in ancient Jerusalem. Don't forget to like and subscribe if you enjoy the content today. And also you can request our free magazine, which goes into the details of this excavation, as well as other events in biblical archaeology and discoveries in biblical archaeology. It's called Let the Stone Speak as well. And you can go to our website, armstronginstitute.org, find a place to sign up on the front page, or you can write an email to letters@armstronginstitute.org and request your free subscription to the magazine that way. Here's the interview. Professor Yosef Garfinkel, here we are in Jerusalem. Thanks for coming on the show again.
Yeah, it's my pleasure.
We were in Lachish at your excavations a few weeks ago. And our scenery has changed, but you're still on an excavation. What can you tell us about this new excavation we're starting here?
First of all, I'd like to say that this summer was very busy for me. First, I excavated Lachish. I have 2 weeks to recover a bit. And here we are in Ophel, 5 weeks, starting a new project. Very, very exciting moment.
So you were excavated a little bit, or actually tell us about your history excavating in Jerusalem, because it goes back some years.
No. First of all, as a student, I excavated with Yigal Shilo in City of David. Mm-hmm. This was maybe 40, 45 years ago, many, many years ago. Anyhow, Jerusalem is an amazing place, an amazing archaeological site, but very difficult. Mm-hmm. Probably Jerusalem is the most difficult archaeological site under Earth because of, on the one hand, so many historical events that took place here. And then so many different archaeologists excavated here. This is a real chaos here.
So when you're talking about the different archaeological periods, here we've only been beginning for the past 2 weeks, but the whole area of the Ophel has been excavated quite a lot over the years.
Behind us there is a huge area, 30 dunams that have been excavated starting in the late 60s and 70s and 80s and 90s. Elat Mazar also added, and Uzi Leibner, altogether there is almost 70 years of excavations in this area. It's unbelievable how intensive is the archaeological activity here in the Ophel. And so, yet, many things are not clear.
Right. So the Ophel, just for people, what is the general area of the Ophel geographically and historically, how was this area used?
You know, they often mention in the Bible 6-7 times, including an Ophel in Samaria. Mm-hmm. And in the Mesha Stila, a Moabite king, he also mentioned an Ophel in Moab. So an Ophel, basically, today we call it the Acropolis, mm-hmm. the high place of the city, the raised area where you have the palaces and the temples.
So this retains its, or gets its name going back to the time of the biblical kings. And then going forward in time, after the destruction, Babylonian destruction, how else was this area used from your recollection? Is it?
You know, we know that there was a late bronze city in Jerusalem. We have rich graves around, and there are letters sent from the kingdom of Jerusalem to the Pharaoh in Amarna. Mm-hmm. But we don't know exactly where is the city, where is the late bronze city. Some people said, like Elat Mazar, that it's down in Ir David around the spring. Some people said it's here on top of the mountain and covered today by Herod great compound. So we don't really know much about the late bronze. Then came the Iron Age. And it's a great question, where is David, Solomon, and all the early kings of the kingdom of Judah? Mm-hmm. And this is one of the reasons that we are excavating here, as to go down to bedrock and to see the earliest remnant from the kingdom of Judah here in the most important part of Jerusalem and the most important part of the kingdom of Judah.
So where we are, this new area, we're calling it Area E, and we are on the very eastern site of the hill itself. Why could that be significant, do you think, for what we might discover here? Because we are, right now, we are maybe 10 meters above bedrock, but we're hopeful in this area.
Basically, we are here at the edge, so it's near the fortifications of the city, and then adjacent to the fortification, as we are in the Ophel, we are in the administrative quarter of the Kingdom of Judah. Mm-hmm. That means that we have a temple, we have a palace, and probably storage houses, and administrative building and so on. The question, what will be found exactly here under our feet, is hard to guess exactly, but it must be an important part of Jerusalem.
So this project that we're beginning, it's going to be a long-term project. This is just the first couple of weeks of perhaps a year or so. And what can you tell us about what we're uncovering over the past couple of weeks in this area?
We started here in the first 2 meters in part of the excavation area, were really modern dump. We have a lot of plastic and nylon bags and so on. That means that it was already excavated and then backfilled by one of the previous expeditions that work here. But luckily enough, in the end of last week, we finished this plastic level and we are now in Byzantine level. We have beginning of a mosaic floor in one of the buildings and other places look like material in situ. So this is very encouraging. But basically, I think that this season we are starting, and next year we are planning a few months of excavations. And I think that the real result will appear in 2028. So this is really a marathon. We need a lot of patience, a lot of hard work, but we are progressing to the right direction.
So what can you tell us a little bit about the team that we have working here so far this first season?
We are working here with students from Armstrong College. They are really amazing person power, men and women together. Unbelievable how strong they are and how the very high motivation is really exceptional. I'm working in archaeology more than 40 years, and I never saw such a group of people as those from Armstrong.
Well, hopefully they can keep up the energy.
I remember that when I worked in Eagle Shiloh team in the early 1980s, and they already mentioned it was Ambassador College at the time, and they already mentioned the Ambassador College volunteers as exceptional. And this has not been changed after 40 years.
Well, that's good. We've got a reputation to uphold.
And, yes.
And it is interesting because where we're sitting is one of the last areas that is yet to be excavated fully.
I know.
And we're continuing with Hebrew University. You're representing Hebrew University. It's under a Hebrew University license, and that's where the work will be published. And yet we're the ambassadors or the Armstrong people are here together after so many years.
I know that you started with Benjamin Mazar in the late 1960s. Then you worked with Yigal Shiloh in the 1980s. Then you worked with Ilat Mazar for many years. Then you worked with Uzi Leibner and Orit Peleg for 5 years. Now we are working together. So archaeologists are changing, but Armstrong remained the same.
Yeah, Armstrong, Hebrew University, and that's what Mr. Armstrong wanted to do. We've got the couple flags over there from Hebrew University and Armstrong Institute. We're very happy to continue. We're happy to continue with you. What can you tell us about Ilat Mazar wanted to excavate this location? She had very bad health, and towards the end of her life, she spoke to you about what she thought could happen following.
You know, Ilat Mazar was sick for a number of years, but this was exactly the corona period. So people didn't come to the university, people didn't see each other. So she managed to keep it as a secret. Mm-hmm. And people really didn't know that she was so ill. And I spoke with her a few times. When there were holidays, I greeted, I phoned her to say hello and so on. And I didn't know that she was sick or anything. But then one time she said, I want to talk with you, please come to my apartment. I came to her apartment and then she told me, I'm very sick. I don't know how long. And I said, I'm very sick. I don't know how long I will live. I want you to continue.
Mm-hmm. And so
here I am.
And here you are. And I remember following her. Following her death, we had an event at the Menachem Begin Center and in her honor. And right after that, I met you and we talked and you mentioned this conversation and how we need to talk about how we can continue here in Jerusalem. And that was going back 5 years ago now.
So, yeah, something like this, 5-6 years ago, yeah.
But here we are. Yeah. We're fulfilling that desire.
Already last year, we excavated about 100 meters down here.
Yep.
In a very well fortified area, which was first discovered by Charles Warren, the first excavation ever done in the Southern Levant in 1867 mm-hmm. was done there. And Ilat continued, she found a gate, and so there was debate if the gate is a gate or not a gate and how to understand this complex. I know that she has one opinion, some people saw that it's not a gate. I personally think that there is a gate, but I have some different understanding of this area. But this is natural. Every archaeologist comes with his own point of view, and sometimes people suggest in different interpretations. But I think that the basic interpretation of Ilat Mazar, that this area is a gate, she was right.
And this is one of the reasons why we're excited about this area, because as you said, we're along the fortification line where the valley starts to, the hill starts to go down to the Kidron Valley. And on the top of the hill, we don't really have many remains from the Iron Age preserved, but as we go down, further along this at the same elevation, we're hopeful that we're going to have some preservation.
The problem is that Herod the Great and other Byzantine and Islamic, they really construct many times on bedrock, mm-hmm. which means they destroyed all the earliest remains. And here at the edge, there is a good chance to have better preservation, especially that we have here a deep section that's going down 6, 7, 8 meters, and we are on top of it. So if the bedrock is indeed so deep, we're going to have a lot of levels from the Iron Age. After all, the Iron Age is when David and Solomon and built the temple. This is when all this area got its importance.
Right.
And then generation, religion after religion, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, they're all following this activity of Solomon and David.
And so, I mean, we don't know what's going to be underneath the ground here, but we're hopeful that perhaps in some time, probably the second or third season, maybe.
I think that only the third season we will have meaningful results. Maybe we'll get something nice in the end of this season.
Yeah.
But if you think realistically about having a large horizontal exposure, having few houses or buildings or rooms, and reach this destruction levels right. from the end of the temple and then earlier level under it, this will take a few years.
Absolutely. And every period, like the walls we can see behind us, they're probably dated to the Umayyad period, then we have the Byzantine period. And each of these layers will be photographed, documented, drawn
sure.
systematically as we go down, and then we'll see what preservation is going to be there.
Yeah, who knows what is still expecting to be uncovered.
That's right. We'll see. Well, thank you very much for your time. Looking forward to share the season with you.
Thank you for all your hard work.
No worries. It's a pleasure.
It's unbelievable how strong these guys working
here. Hear that, guys? You got to keep it up.
Toda rabah.
Okay. Thanks very much to Professor Garfinkel for taking time out of the dig right before we conclude today for that interview. Again, don't forget to like and subscribe to the channel if you enjoyed this, and you can follow our excavation blog. That's at thearmstronginstitute.org, and you'll see a big banner over the top of the page, and there we update you with photos, pictures, and some content a few times a week to let you know what we're uncovering here on the Ophel in ancient Jerusalem.
The South Korean Marine Corps announced August 24th that the United States will not participate in next month's Twin Dragon joint amphibious exercise. The U.S. cited a strain on resources due to the war on Iran. South Korea was notified of this decision in June. The exercise, which has been held every other year since 2012, generally includes naval vessels, aircraft, and more than 10,000 Marines. Part of the reason for the exercise is to show North Korea and China that the U.S. military backs South Korea. The announcement came 8 days after President Trump announced the U.S. was significantly cutting back its participation in planned late August military exercises with South Korea. In the social media post announcing the decision, President Trump said he had a very good relationship with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and stated that North Korea has been unthreatening and respectful. Days later, North Korea test-launched 10 ballistic missiles in a show of force and defiance. Prophecy speaks plainly of the realignment of power within Asia, with America losing its presence there in favor of a massive Russia-China-led conglomeration. To understand more about these trends, read Russia and China in Prophecy. On August 18th, the German Aerospace Center opened its Drone Security Technology Center in Saxony-Anhalt, a facility for researching, developing, and testing military drones. The opening came just 2 weeks after an explosive-laden drone was found at Leipzig-Halle Airport amid fears of Russian hybrid warfare. Hybrid threats are pushing Germany to rapidly advance its capacity for drone defense, including drone detection, jamming, and hijacking. Spiegel reported August 18th that there were 116 drone incidents at German airports last year, many believed to be linked to Russia. In March, the government amended air security laws to allow the military to shoot down drones. Last week, The Telegraph reported that Russia has built or expanded at least 10 drone border area military bases in striking distance of NATO. To learn more about why Germany is so concerned about Russia, read Chapter 8 of the Holy Roman Empire in Prophecy. The United Arab Emirates announced August 19th that it is halting all trade and financial dealings with Iran, claiming this was in response to Iran launching missiles toward it, though there has been no confirmed strike against the UAE since May. The government accused Iran of regional escalations that undermine regional and international peace and security. The United Arab Emirates was reportedly struck by more Iranian missiles and drones in the active fighting of the Iran war from March to April than any other Middle Eastern country, even Israel. The UAE and Israel have had a close relationship since the Abraham Accords were signed in 2020. Analysts interpret Iran's targeting of the UAE as punishment for working with Israel. Even as the UAE has worked with Israel and the US, it has remained a major economic partner of Iran. The Iran war has shown the UAE that it can't be friends with both. But the recent announcement doesn't mean the UAE is on the side of freedom and democracy now either. To understand this nation's role in end-time prophecy, read Deadly Flaw in Mideast Peace Deals. To learn more about current world news and how it relates to Bible prophecy, please visit thetrumpet.com.